we'd just left, I heard bangs and screams, as if mackerel were running across a hot skillet strewn with popcorn kernels. I saw no sign of Grover. When we reached the end of the aisle, a store clerk rounded the corner, his label gun raised.
Hi-ya!
Hedge executed a roundhouse kick on him. This was a notoriously difficult move. Even Ares sometimes fell and broke his tailbone when practicing it in his dojo. Witness the Ares So Lame video that went viral on Mount Olympus last year, and which I absolutely was not responsible for uploading. To my surprise, Coach Hedge executed it perfectly. His hoof connected with the clerk's face, knocking the automaton's head clean off. The body dropped to its knees and fell forward, wires sparking in its neck.
Wow!
Gleason examined his hoof. I guess that iron goat conditioning wax really works. The clerk's decapitated body gave me flashbacks to the Indianapolis Blemyai, who lost their fake heads with great regularity. But I had no time to dwell on the terrible past when I had such a terrible present to deal with. Behind us, Macro called,
Oh, what have you done now?
The manager stood at the far end of the lane, his clothes smeared with soot, his yellow vest peppered with so many holes it looked like a smoking piece of Swiss cheese. Yet somehow, just my luck, he appeared unharmed. The second store clerk stood behind him, apparently unconcerned that his robotic head was on fire.
Apollo,
Macro chided.
There's no point in fighting my automatons. This is a military surplus store. I have 50 more just like these in storage.
I glanced at Hedge. Let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Hedge grabbed a croquet mallet from a nearby rack.
50 may be too many even for me.
We skirted the camping tents, then zigzagged through hockey heaven, trying to make our way back to the store entrance. A few aisles away, Macro was shouting orders.
Get them! I'm not going to be forced to commit suicide again.
Again?
Hedge muttered, ducking under the arm of a hockey mannequin.
He worked for the Emperor, I panted, trying to keep up. Old friends. But,
Wheeze,
Emperor didn't trust him.
Ordered his arrest.
Wheeze.
Execution. We stopped at an end cap. Gleason peeked around the corner for signs of hostiles.
So Macro committed suicide instead? Hedge asked. What a moron. Why is he working for this Emperor again, if the guy wanted him killed?
I wiped the sweat from my eyes. Honestly, why did mortal bodies have to sweat so much? I imagine the Emperor brought him back to life, gave him a second chance. Romans have strange ideas about loyalty. Hedge grunted.
Speaking of which, where's Grover?
Halfway back to the cistern, if he's smart. Hedge frowned.
Nah, can't believe he'd do that. Well,
he pointed ahead, where sliding glass doors led out to the parking lot. The coach's yellow Pinto was parked tantalizingly close. Which is the first time yellow, Pinto, and tantalizingly have ever been used together in a sentence.
You ready?
We charged the doors. The doors did not cooperate. I slammed into one and bounced right off. Gleason hammered at the glass with his croquet mallet, then tried a few Chuck Norris kicks. But even his iron goat-waxed hooves didn't leave a scratch. Behind us, Macro said,
Oh, dear.
I turned, trying to suppress a whimper. The manager stood 20 feet away, under a whitewater raft that was suspended from the ceiling with a sign across its prow, Boatloads of Savings. I was beginning to appreciate why the Emperor had ordered Macro arrested and executed. For such a big man, he was much too good at sneaking up on people.
Those glass doors are bomb-proof,
Macro said.
We have some for sale this week in our fallout shelter improvement department. But I suppose that wouldn't do you any good.
From various aisles, more yellow-vested employees converged. A dozen identical automatons, some covered in bubble wrap, as if they'd just broken out of storage. They formed a rough semicircle behind Macro.
I drew my bow. I fired a shot at Macro. But my hands shook so badly the arrow missed,
embedding itself in an automaton's bubble-wrapped forehead with a crisp pop. The robot barely seemed to notice.
Hmm. Macro grimaced. You really are quite mortal, aren't you? I guess it's true what people say. Never meet your gods. They'll only disappoint you. I just hope there's enough of you left for the Emperor's magical friend to work with.
Enough of me?
I stammered. Magical friend? I waited for Gleason Hedge to do something clever and heroic. Surely he had a portable bazooka in the pocket of his gym shorts. Or perhaps his coach's whistle was magic. But Hedge looked as cornered and desperate as I felt, which wasn't fair. Cornered and desperate was my job. Macro cracked his knuckles.
It's a shame, really. I'm much more loyal than she is, but I shouldn't complain. Once I bring you to the Emperor, I'll be rewarded. My automatons will be given a second chance as the Emperor's personal guard. After that, what do I care? The sorceress can take you into the maze and do her magic.
Her magic?
Hedge lifted his croquet mallet.
I'll take out as many as I can, he muttered to me.
You find another exit.
I appreciated the sentiment. Unfortunately, I didn't think the satyr would be able to buy me much of a head start. Also, I didn't like the idea of returning to that kind, sleep-deprived cloud nymph Melly and informing her that her husband had been killed by a squad of bubble-wrapped robots. Oh, my mortal sympathies really were getting the best of me. Who is this sorceress? I demanded. What does she intend to do with me? Macro's smile was cold and insincere. I had used that smile myself many times in the old days, whenever some Greek town prayed to me to save them from a plague, and I had to break the news. Gee, I'm sorry. But I caused that plague because I don't like you. Have a nice day.
You'll see soon enough, Macro promised. I didn't believe her when she said you'd walk right into our trap, but here you are. She predicted that you wouldn't be able to resist the burning maze. Ah, well, military madness team members, kill the satyr and apprehend the former god.
The automaton shuffled forward. At the same moment, a blur of green, red, and brown near the ceiling caught my eye. A satyr-like shape leaping from the top of the nearest aisle, swinging off a fluorescent light fixture, and landing in the whitewater raft above Macro's head. Before I could shout Grover Underwood, the raft landed on top of Macro and his minions, burying them under a boatload of savings. Grover leaped free, a paddle in his hand, and yelled, "Come on!" The confusion allowed us a few moments to flee. But with the exit doors locked, we could only run deeper into the store.
"Nice one!"
Hedge slapped Grover on the back as we raced through the camouflage department.
"I knew you wouldn't leave us."
"Yes, but there's no nature anywhere in here," Grover complained. No plants, no dirt, no natural light. How are we supposed to fight in these conditions?
Guns,
Hedge suggested. That whole part of the store is on fire, Grover said, thanks to a Molotov cocktail and some ammo boxes.
Curses, said the coach.
We passed a display of martial arts weapons, and Hedge's eyes lit up. He quickly exchanged his croquet mallet for a pair of nunchaku.
Now we're talking. You guys want some shurikens or a kusarigama?
I want to run away, Grover said, shaking his boat paddle.
Coach, you have to stop thinking about full frontal assaults. You have a family.
Don't you think I know that? Coach growled. We tried settling down with the McLeans in L.A. Look how well that turned out.
I guess there was a story there. Why they had come from L.A. Why Hedge sounded so bitter about it. But while fleeing from enemies in a surplus store was perhaps not the best time to talk about it. I suggest we find another exit, I said. We can run away and argue about ninja weapons at the same time. This compromise seemed to satisfy them both. We sped past a display of inflatable swimming pools. How were those military surplus? Then turned a corner and saw in front of us, at the far rear corner of the building, a set of double doors labeled Employees Only. Grover and Hedge charged ahead, leaving me gasping in their wake. From somewhere nearby, Macro's voice called,
You can't escape, Apollo. I've already called the horse. He'll be here any minute.
The horse? Why did that term send a B major chord of terror vibrating through my bones? I searched my jumbled memories for a clear answer but came up empty. My first thought. Maybe the horse was a nom de guerre. Perhaps the Emperor employed an evil wrestler who wore a black satin cape, shiny spandex shorts, and a horsehead-shaped helmet. My second thought. Why did Macro get to call for backup when I could not? Demigod communications had been magically sabotaged for months. Phones short-circuited, computers melted. Iris messages and magical scrolls failed to work. Yet our enemies seemed to have no trouble texting each other messages like, Apollo, my place. Where you at? Help me kill him. It wasn't fair. Fair would have been me getting my immortal powers back and blasting our enemies to tiny pieces. We burst through the employees-only doors. Inside was a storage room slash loading bay, filled with more bubble-wrapped automatons, all standing silent and lifeless, like the crowd at one of Hestia's housewarming parties. She may be the goddess of the family hearth, but the lady has no clue about how to throw a party. Gleason and Grover ran past the robots and began tugging at the rolling metal garage door that sealed off the loading dock. Locked! Hedge whacked the door with his nunchaku. I peered out the tiny plastic windows of the employee doors. Macro and his minions were barreling in our direction. Run or stay? I asked. We're about to be cornered again.
Apollo, what have you got?
Hedge demanded.
What do you mean?
What's the ace up your sleeve? I did the Molotov cocktail. Grover dropped the boat. It's your turn. Godly fire, maybe? We could use some godly fire.
I have zero godly fire up my sleeves.
We stay, Grover decided. He tossed me his boat paddle. Apollo, block those doors.
But just keep Macro out.
Grover must have been taking assertiveness lessons from Meg. I jumped to comply. Coach, Grover continued, can you play a song of opening for the loading dock door? Hedge grunted.
Haven't done one of those in years, but I'll try. What'll you be doing?
Grover studied the dormant automatons.
Something my friend Annabeth taught me.
Hurry! I slipped the paddle through the door handles, then lugged over a tetherball pole and braced it against the door.
Hedge began to trill a tune on his coach's whistle. The Entertainer by Scott Joplin. I'd never thought of the whistle as a musical instrument.
Coach Hedge's performance did nothing to change my mind. Meanwhile, Grover ripped the plastic off the nearest automaton. He rapped his knuckles against its forehead, which made a hollow clang.
Celestial bronze, all right, Grover decided. This might work.
What are you going to do?
I demanded.
Melt them down for weapons?
No.
Activate them to work for us. They won't help us. They belong to Macro. Speak of the Praetor.
Macro pushed against the doors, rattling the paddle and the tetherball pole brace.
Oh, come on, Apollo. Stop being difficult.
Grover pulled the bubble wrap off another automaton.
During the Battle of Manhattan, he said, when we were fighting Kronos, Annabeth told us about an override command written into the firmware of automatons.
That's only for public statuary in Manhattan, I said.
Every god who's any god knows that. You can't expect these things to respond to command sequence Daedalus 23.
Instantly, as in a scary episode of Doctor Who, the plastic-wrapped automatons snapped to attention and turned to face me.
Yes!
Grover yelled gleefully. I did not feel so gleeful. I just activated a room full of metal temp workers who were more likely to kill me than obey me. I had no idea how Annabelle Chase had figured out that the Daedalus command could be used on any automaton. Then again, she'd been able to redesign my palace on Mount Olympus with perfect acoustics and surround sound speakers in the bathroom. So her cleverness shouldn't have surprised me. Coach Hedge kept trilling Scott Joplin. The loading bay door didn't move. Macro and his men banged against my makeshift barricade, nearly making me lose my grip on the tetherball pole.
Apollo, talk to the automatons, Grover said. They're waiting for your orders now. Tell them begin plan Thermopylae.
I didn't like being reminded of Thermopylae. So many brave and attractive Spartans had died in that battle, defending Greece from the Persians. But I did as I was told.
Begin plan Thermopylae!
At that moment, Macro and his 12 servants busted through the doors, snapping the paddle, knocking aside the tetherball pole, and launching me into the midst of my new metal acquaintances. Macro stumbled to a halt, 6 minions fanning out on either side.
What's this? Apollo! You can't activate my automatons! You haven't paid for them! Military Madness team members, apprehend Apollo! Tear the satyrs apart! Stop that infernal whistling!
2 things saved us from instant death. First, Macro had made the mistake of issuing too many orders at once. As any maestro can tell you, a conductor should never simultaneously order the violins to speed up, the timpani to soften, and the brass to crescendo. You will end up with a symphonic train wreck. Macro's poor soldiers were left to decide for themselves whether they should first apprehend me, or tear apart the satyrs, or stop the whistling. Personally, I would have gone after the whistler with extreme prejudice. The other thing that saved us? Rather than listening to Macro, our new temp worker friends began executing Plan Thermopylae. They shuffled forward, linking their arms and surrounding Macro and his companions, who awkwardly tried to get around their robotic colleagues and bumped into each other in confusion. The scene was reminding me more of a Hestia housewarming by the second.
Stop this! Macro shrieked. I order you to stop!
This only added to the confusion. Macro's faithful minions froze in their tracks, allowing our Daedalus-operated dudes to encircle Macro's group.
No, not you! Macro yelled to his minions. You all don't stop! You keep fighting!
Which did nothing to clarify the situation. The Daedalus dudes encircled their comrades, squeezing them in a massive group hug. Despite Macro's size and strength, he was trapped in the center, squirming and shoving uselessly.
No! I can't!
He spat bubble wrap from his mouth.
Help! The horse can't see me like this!
From deep in their chests, the Daedalus dudes began to emit a hum, like engines stuck in the wrong gear. Steam rose from the seams of their necks. I backed away, as one does when a group of robots starts to steam. Grover, what exactly is Plan Thermopylae?
the satyr gulped. They're supposed to stand their ground so we can retreat.
Then why are they steaming?
I asked.
Also, why are they starting to glow red?
Oh, dear. Grover chewed his lower lip.
They may have confused Plan Thermopylae with Plan Petersburg.
Which means
they may be about to sacrifice themselves in a fiery explosion.
Coach, I yelled.
Whistle better!
I threw myself at the loading bay door, working my fingers under the bottom and lifting with all my pathetic mortal strength. I whistled along with Hedge's frantic tune. I even tap danced a little, since that is well known to speed up musical spells. Behind us, Macro shrieked,
"Hot! Hot!"
My clothes felt uncomfortably warm, as if I were sitting at the edge of a bonfire. After our experience with the wall of flames in the labyrinth, I did not want to take my chances with a group hug slash explosion in this small room.
"Lift!"
I yelled.
"Whistle!"
Grover joined in our desperate Joplin performance. Finally, the loading bay door began to budge, creaking in protest as we raised it a few inches off the floor. Macro's shrieking became unintelligible. The humming and heat reminded me of that moment just before my sun chariot would take off, blasting into the sky in a triumph of solar power.
"Go!" I yelled to the satyrs. "Both of you, roll under!"
I thought that was quite heroic of me. Though, to be honest, I half expected them to insist, "Oh no, please, gods first!" No such courtesy. The satyrs shimmied under the door, then held it from the other side while I tried to wriggle through the gap. Alas, I found myself stymied by my own accursed love handles. In short, I got stuck.
"Apollo, come on!"
Grover yelled.
"I'm trying!"
"Suck it in, boy!"
screamed the coach. I'd never had a personal trainer before. Gods simply don't need someone yelling at them, shaming them into working harder. And honestly, who would want that job? Knowing you could get zapped by lightning the first time you chided your client into doing an extra 5 push-ups. This time, however, I was glad to be yelled at. The coach's exhortations gave me the extra burst of motivation I needed to squeeze my flabby mortal body through the gap. No sooner had I gotten to my feet than Grover yelled,
"Dive!"
We leaped off the edge of the loading dock as the steel door, which was apparently not bomb-proof, exploded behind us. Chapter 9. Collect call from horse. Do you accept the charges?
Nay,
Oh, villainy. Please explain to me why I always end up falling into dumpsters. I must confess, however, that this dumpster saved my life. Macro's military madness went up in a chain of explosions that shook the desert, rattling the flaps of the foul-smelling metal box that sheltered us. Sweating and shivering, barely able to breathe, the two satyrs and I huddled amid trash bags and listened to the pitter-patter of debris raining from the sky. An unexpected downpour of wood, plaster, glass, and sporting equipment. After what seemed like years, I was about to risk speaking. Something like, "Get me out of here or I'm going to vomit," when Grover clamped his hand over my mouth. I could barely see him in the dark, but he shook his head urgently, his eyes wide with alarm. Coach Hedge also looked tense. His nose quivered as if he smelled something even worse than the garbage. Then I heard the clop, clop, clop of hooves against asphalt as they approached our hiding place.
A deep voice grumbled, "Well, this is just perfect."
An animal's muzzle snuffled the rim of our dumpster, perhaps smelling for survivors. For us, I tried not to weep or wet my pants. I succeeded at one of those. I'll let you decide which. The flaps of the dumpster remained closed. Perhaps the garbage and the burning warehouse masked our scent.
Hey, Big C,
said the same deep voice.
Yeah, it's me.
From the lack of audible response, I guess the newcomer was talking on the phone.
Nah, the place is gone. I don't know. Macro must have.
He paused, as if the person on the other end had launched into a tirade.
I know, said the newcomer. Could have been a false alarm, but... Ah, nuts. Human police are on the way.
A moment after he said that, I heard the faint sound of sirens in the distance.
I could search the area,
the newcomer suggested.
Maybe check those ruins up the hill.
Hedge and Grover exchanged a worried look. Surely the ruins meant our sanctuary, currently housing Melly, Baby Hedge, and Meg.
I know you think you took care of it, said the newcomer. But look, that place is still dangerous. I'm telling you.
This time I could hear a faint, tinny voice raging on the other end of the line.
Okay, see, said the newcomer. Yes, Jupiter's jumpers, calm down. I'll just... Fine. Fine. I'm on my way back.
His exasperated sigh told me the call must have ended.
Kid's gonna give me colic.
The speaker grumbled aloud to himself. Something slammed into the side of our dumpster right next to my face. Then the hooves galloped away. Several minutes passed before I felt safe enough even to look at the two satyrs. We silently agreed that we had to get out of the dumpster before we died of suffocation, heat stroke, or the smell of my pants. Outside, the alley was littered with smoking chunks of twisted metal and plastic. The warehouse itself was a blackened shell, flames still swirling within, adding more columns of smoke to the ash-choked night sky.
Who was that? Grover asked.
He smelled like a guy on a horse, but... Coach Hedge's nunchaku clattered in his hands.
Maybe a centaur?
No. I put my hand on the dented metal side of the dumpster, which now bore the unmistakable impression of a shod hoof. He was a horse. A talking horse. The satyrs stared at me.
All horses talk, Grover said. They just talk in horse.
Wait,
Hedge frowned at me.
You mean you understood the horse?
Yes, I said. That horse spoke in English. They waited for me to explain, but I couldn't make myself say more. Now that we were out of immediate danger, now that my adrenaline was ebbing, I found myself gripped by a cold, heavy despair. If I'd harbored any last hopes that I might be wrong about the enemy we were facing, those hopes had been torpedoed. Gaius Julius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. Strangely enough, that name could have applied to several famous ancient Romans, but the master of Navius Sertorius Macro? Big C? Neos Helios? The only Roman emperor ever to possess a talking horse. That could mean only one person. One terrible person. The flashing lights of emergency vehicles pulsed against the fronds of the nearest palm trees. We need to get out of here, I said. Gleason stared at the wreckage of the surplus store.
Yeah. Let's go around front, see if my car survived. I just wish I got some camping supplies out of this deal.
We got something much worse. I took a shaky breath. We got the identity of the third emperor. The explosion hadn't scathed the coach's yellow 1979 Ford Pinto. Of course it hadn't. Such a hideous car couldn't be destroyed by anything less than a worldwide apocalypse. I sat in back, wearing a new pair of hot pink camo pants we'd salvaged from the army surplus wreckage. I was in such a stupor I barely remember going through the drive-through lane of Enchiladas Del Rey and picking up enough combo plates to feed several dozen nature spirits. Back at the hilltop ruins, we convened a council of the cacti. The cistern was packed with desert plant dryads, Joshua tree, prickly pear, aloe vera, and many more, all dressed in bristly clothes and doing their best not to poke each other. Melly fussed over Gleason, one minute showering him with kisses and telling him how brave he was, the next minute punching him and accusing him of wanting her to raise baby Hedge by herself as a widow. The infant, whose name I learned was Chuck, was awake and none too happy, kicking his little hooves into his father's stomach as Gleason tried to hold him, tugging Hedge's goatee with his chubby little fists.
"On the bright side," Hedge told Melly, "we got enchiladas, and I scored some awesome nunchaku."
Melly gazed heavenward, perhaps wishing she could go back to her simple life as an unmarried cloud. As for Meg McCaffrey, she had regained consciousness and looked as well as she ever looked. Just slightly greasier, thanks to the first aid ministrations of aloe vera. Meg sat at the edge of the pool, trailing her bare feet in the water and stealing glances at Joshua Tree, who stood nearby, brooding handsomely in his khakis. I asked Meg how she was feeling, because I am nothing if not thoughtful. But she waved me off, insisting she was fine. I think she was just embarrassed by my presence as she tried to discreetly ogle Joshua, which made me roll my eyes. "Girl, I see you," I felt like saying. "You are not subtle, and we really need to have a talk about crushing on dryads." I didn't want her to order me to slap myself, however, so I kept my mouth shut. Grover distributed enchilada plates to everyone. He ate nothing himself, a sure sign of how nervous he felt, but paced the circumference of the pool, tapping his fingers against his reed pipes.
"Guys," he announced, "we've got problems."
I would not have imagined Grover Underwood as a leader. Nevertheless, as he spoke, all the other nature spirits gave him their full attention. Even baby Chuck quieted down, tilting his head toward Grover's voice as if it was something interesting and possibly worth kicking. Grover related everything that had happened to us since we'd met up in Indianapolis. He recounted our days in the labyrinth, the pits and poison lakes, a sudden wave of fire, the flock of strixes, and the spiral ramp that had led us up to these ruins. The dryads looked around nervously, as if imagining the cistern filled with demonic owls.
"You sure we're safe?"
asked a short, plump girl with a lilting accent and red flowers in her hair, or perhaps sprouting from her hair.
"I don't know, Reba."
Grover glanced at Meg and me.
"This is Rebutia, guys. Reba for short. She's a transplant from Argentina."
I waved politely. I'd never met an Argentinian cactus before, but I had a soft spot for Buenos Aires.
"You haven't really tangoed until you've tangoed with a Greek god at La Ventana."
Grover continued.
"I don't think that exit from the maze has ever been there before. It's sealed now. I think the labyrinth was helping us, bringing us home."
"Helping us?"
Prickly Pear looked up from her cheese enchiladas.
"The same labyrinth harboring fires that are destroying the whole state? The same labyrinth we've been exploring for months, trying to find the source of those fires with no luck? The same labyrinth that swallowed a dozen of our search parties? What does it look like when the labyrinth isn't helping us?"
The other dryads grumbled in agreement. Some bristled, literally. Grover raised his hands for calm. I know we're all worried and frustrated, but the Burning Maze isn't the entire labyrinth. And at least now we have some idea why the Emperor set it up the way he did. It's because of Apollo. Dozens of cactus spirits turned to stare at me. Just to clarify, I said in a small voice, it's not my fault. Tell them, Grover. Tell your very nice, very spiny friends it isn't my fault. Coach Hedge grunted.
Well, it kind of is. Macro said the maze was a trap for you, probably because of the oracle thingy you're looking for.
Melly's gaze ping-ponged between her husband and me. Macro? Oracle thingy? I explained how Zeus had me traveling around the country, freeing ancient oracles as part of my penance, because that's just the sort of horrible father he was. Hedge then recounted our fun shopping expedition to Macro's military madness. When he got sidetracked talking about the various types of landmines he'd found, Grover intervened. So we exploded Macro, Grover summed up, who was a Roman follower of this emperor. And he mentioned some kind of a sorceress who wants to, I don't know, do some evil magic on Apollo, I guess. And she's helping the Emperor. And we think they put the next oracle... The Sibyl of Erythria, I said.
Right, Grover agreed.
We think they put her at the center of the maze as some sort of bait for Apollo. Also, there's a talking horse. Melly's face clouded over, which was unsurprising since she was a cloud. All horses talk. Grover explained what we'd heard in the dumpster. Then he backed up and explained why we'd been in a dumpster. Then he explained how I'd wet my pants, and that was why I was wearing hot pink camo. Oh. All the dryads nodded, as if this was the real question that had been bothering them. Can we get back to the problem at hand? I pleaded. We have a common cause. You want the fire stopped. I have a quest to free the Erythrian Sibyl. Both those things require us to find the heart of the maze. That's where we'll find the source of the flames and the Sibyl. I know it. Meg studied me intently, as if trying to decide what embarrassing order she should give me. Jump into the pool, hug prickly pear, find a shirt that matches your pants. Tell me about the horse, she said. Order received. I had no choice. His name is Incitatus. And he talks, Meg said, like in a way humans can understand. Yes. Though normally he only speaks to the Emperor. Don't ask me how he talks or where he came from, I don't know. He's a magical horse. The Emperor trusts him probably more than he trusts anyone. Back when the Emperor ruled ancient Rome, he dressed Incitatus in senatorial purple, even tried to make him a consul. People thought the Emperor was crazy, but he was never crazy. Meg leaned over the pool, hunching her shoulders as if withdrawing into her mental shell. With Meg, emperors were always a touchy subject. Raised in Nero's household, though the terms abused and gaslighted were more accurate, she'd betrayed me to Nero at Camp Half-Blood before returning to me in Indianapolis, a subject we'd skirted without really addressing for a while. I did not blame the poor girl, truly. But getting her to trust my friendship, to trust anyone after her stepfather Nero, was like training a wild squirrel to eat out of one's hand. Any loud noise was liable to cause her to flee or bite, or both. I realize that's not a fair comparison. Meg bites much harder than a wild squirrel. Finally, she said, that line from the prophecy, the master of the swift white horse, I nodded.
Incitatus belongs to the Emperor. Or perhaps belong isn't the right word. Incitatus is the right-hand horse to the man who now claims the Western United States. Gaius Julius Caesar Germanicus. This was the Dryad's cue for a collective gasp of horror, and perhaps some ominous background music. Instead, blank faces greeted me. The only ominous background sound was baby Chuck chewing the styrofoam lid of his father's No. 3 dinner especial. "This Gaius person," said Meg.
"Is he famous?"
I stared at the dark waters of the pool. I almost wished Meg would order me to jump in and drown. Or force me to wear a shirt that matched my hot pink pants. Either punishment would have been easier than answering her question. "The Emperor is better known by his childhood nickname," I said, "which he despises, by the way. History remembers him as Caligula." Chapter 10. Cute kid you got there, with the itty-bitty boots and murderous grin. Do you know the name Caligula, dear listener? If not, consider yourself lucky. All around the cistern, cactus dryads puffed out their spikes. Melly's lower half dissolved into mist. Even baby Chuck coughed up a piece of styrofoam.
"Caligula!"
Coach Hedge's eye twitched the same way it had when Melly threatened to take away his ninja weapons.
"Are you sure?"
I wished I wasn't. I wished I could announce that the third emperor was kindly old Marcus Aurelius, or noble Hadrian, or bumbling Claudius. But Caligula. Even for those who knew little about him, the name Caligula conjured the darkest, most depraved images. His reign was bloodier and more infamous than Nero's, who had grown up in awe of his wicked great-uncle, Gaius Julius Caesar Germanicus. Caligula, a byword for murder, torture, madness, excess. Caligula, the villainous tyrant against whom all other villainous tyrants were measured. Caligula, who had a worse branding problem than the Edsel, the Hindenburg, and the Chicago Black Sox put together. Grover shuddered.
"I've always hated that name. What does it mean, anyway? Satyr killer? Blood drinker?"
"Booties," I said. Joshua's shaggy olive hair stood straight up, which Meg seemed to find fascinating.
"Booties?"
Joshua glanced around the cistern, perhaps wondering if he'd missed the joke. No one was laughing. "Yes. I could still remember how cute little Caligula had looked in his miniature legionnaire's outfit when he accompanied his father Germanicus on military campaigns. Why were sociopaths always so adorable as children? His father's soldiers gave Caligula the nickname when he was a child," I said. "He wore teeny-weeny legionnaire's boots. Caligae. And they thought that was hysterical. So they called him Caligula, little boots, or baby shoes, or booties. Pick your translation." Prickly Pear stabbed her fork into her enchiladas. "I don't care if the guy's name is Snookums McCuddleface. How do we beat him and get our lives back to normal?" The other cacti grumbled and nodded. I was starting to suspect that prickly pears were the natural agitators of the cactus world. Get enough of them together and they would start a revolution and overthrow the animal kingdom. "We have to be careful," I warned. "Caligula is a master at trapping his enemies. The old saying, give them enough rope to hang themselves, that was made for Caligula. He delights in his reputation as a madman, but it's just a cover. He's quite sane. He's also completely amoral, even worse than..." I stopped myself. I'd been about to say worse than Nero, but how could I make such a claim in front of Meg, whose entire childhood had been poisoned by Nero and his alter ego, the Beast?
"Careful, Meg," Nero would always say. "Don't misbehave, or you'll wake the Beast. I love you dearly, but the Beast... well, I would hate to see you do something wrong and get hurt."
How could I quantify such villainy? "Anyway," I said, "Caligula is smart, patient, and paranoid. If this burning maze is some elaborate trap, part of some bigger plan of his, it won't be easy to shut down. And beating him, even finding him, will be a challenge." I was tempted to add, "Perhaps we don't want to find him. Perhaps we should run away." That wouldn't work for the Dryads. They were rooted, quite literally, to the land in which they grew. Transplants like Reba were rare. Few nature spirits could survive being potted and transported to a new environment. Even if every Dryad here managed to flee the fires of Southern California, thousands more would stay and burn. Grover shuddered. "If half the stuff I've heard about Caligula is true..." He paused, apparently realizing that everyone was watching him, gauging how much they should panic based on Grover's reactions. I, for one, did not want to be in the middle of a room filled with cacti that were running around screaming. Fortunately, Grover kept his cool. "Nobody is unbeatable," he declared. "Not titans, giants, or gods. And definitely not some Roman emperor named Booties. This guy is causing Southern California to wither and die. He's behind the droughts, the heat, the fires. We have to find a way to stop him. Apollo, how did Caligula die the first time?" I tried to remember. As usual, my mortal hard drive of a brain was shot full of holes. But I seemed to recall a dark tunnel packed with Praetorian guards crowding around the emperor, their knives flashing and glistening with blood. "His own guards killed him," I said, which I'm sure has made him even more paranoid. Macro mentioned that the emperor kept changing his personal guard. First, automatons replaced the praetors. Then he changed them again to mercenaries and strixes and... big ears? I don't know what that means. One of the Dryads huffed indignantly. I guessed she was Choya, since she looked like a Choya plant. Wispy white hair, a fuzzy white beard, and large paddle-shaped ears covered with bristles. No decent big-eared person would work for such a villain. What about other weaknesses? The Emperor must have some.
Yeah, Coach Hedge chimed in. Is he scared of goats?
Is he allergic to cactus sap? Oliveira asked hopefully. Not that I know of, I said. The assembled Dryads looked disappointed.
You said you got a prophecy in Indiana? Joshua asked. Any clues there?
His tone was skeptical, which I could understand. A Hoosier prophecy just doesn't have the same ring to it as a Delphic prophecy. I have to find the Westward Palace, I said, which must mean Caligula's base.
No one knows where that is, grumbled Pear.
Perhaps it was my imagination, but Melly and Gleason seemed to exchange an anxious look. I waited for them to say something else, but they did not. Also from the prophecy, I continued, I have to wrest from him the crossword speaker's breath. Meaning, I think, that I have to free the Erythrian Sibyl from his control.
Does this Sibyl like crosswords? Reba asked.
I like crosswords.
The Oracle gave her prophecies in the form of word puzzles, I explained. Like crosswords, or acrostics. The prophecy also talks about Grover bringing us here, and a lot of terrible things that will happen at Camp Jupiter in the next few days.
The new moon, Meg muttered. Coming very soon.
Yes. I tried to contain my annoyance. Meg seemed to want me to be in two places at once, which would have been no problem for Apollo the god. For Lester the human, I could barely manage being in one place at once.
There's another line, Grover remembered. Walk the path in thine own enemy's boots? Could that have something to do with Caligula's booties?
I imagined my ginormous 16-year-old feet crammed into a Roman toddler's military-issued leather baby shoes. My toes began to throb.
I hope not, I said. But if we could free the Sibyl from the maze, I'm sure she would help us. I'd like to have more guidance before I charge off to confront Caligula in person.
Other things I would have liked. My godly powers back. The entire firearms department of Macro's military madness, locked and loaded in the hands of a demigod army. An apology letter from my father, Zeus, promising never again to turn me into a human, and a bath. But, as they say, Lesters can't be choosers.
That brings us back to where we started, Joshua said. You need the Oracle freed. We need the fire shut off. To do that, we need to get through the maze. But nobody knows how.
Gleason Hedge cleared his throat.
Maybe somebody does.
Never before had so many cacti stared at a satyr.
Choya stroked her wispy white beard. Who is this somebody?
Hedge turned to his wife, as if to say, All you, sweetie. Melly spent a few more microseconds pondering the night sky, and possibly her former life as a nebulous bachelorette.
Most of you know we've been living with the McLeans, she said.
As in Piper McLean, I explained. Daughter of Aphrodite. I remembered her. One of the seven demigods who had sailed aboard the Argo II. In fact, I'd been hoping to call on her and her boyfriend, Jason Grace, while I was in Southern California, to see if they would defeat the Emperor and free the Oracle for me. Wait, scratch that. I meant, of course, that I hoped they would help me do those things.
Melly nodded. I was Mr. McLean's personal assistant. Gleason was a full-time stay-at-home father, doing a great job.
I was, wasn't I?
Gleason agreed, giving baby Chuck the chain of his nunchaku to tease on.
Until everything went wrong, Melly said with a sigh.
Meg McCaffrey tilted her head.
What do you mean?
Long story, said the cloud nymph, in a tone that implied, I could tell you, but then I'd have to turn into a storm cloud and cry a lot and zap you with lightning and kill you.
The point is, a couple of weeks ago, Piper had a dream about the burning maze. She thought she'd found a way to reach the center. She went exploring with that boy, Jason.
That boy. My finely tuned senses told me Melly was not happy with Jason Grace, son of Jupiter.
When they came back?
Melly paused, her lower half swirling in a corkscrew of cloud stuff.
They said they had failed, but I don't think that's the whole story. Piper hinted that they had encountered something down there that rattled them.
The stone walls of the cistern seemed to creak and shift in the cooling night air, as if sympathetically vibrating with the word rattled. I thought of my dream about the Sibyl in fiery chains, apologizing to someone after delivering terrible news. I am sorry. I would spare you if I could. I would spare her. Had she been addressing Jason? Or Piper? Or both of them? If so, and if they had actually found the Oracle. We need to talk to those demigods, I decided.
Melly lowered her head. I can't take you. Going back, it would break my heart.
Hedge shifted baby Chuck to his other arm.
Maybe I could.
Melly shot him a warning look.
Yeah, I can't go either.
Hedge muttered.
I'll take you.
Grover volunteered, though he looked more exhausted than ever.
I know where the McLean house is. Just, maybe we can wait until the morning.
A sense of relief washed over the assembled dryads. Their spikes relaxed. The chlorophyll came back into their complexions. Grover may not have solved their problems, but he had given them hope. At the very least, a sense that we could do something. I gazed at the circle of hazy orange sky above the cistern. I thought about the fires blazing to the west and what might be going on up north at Camp Jupiter. Sitting at the bottom of a shaft in Palm Springs, unable to help the Roman demigods or even know what was happening to them, I could empathize with the dryads. Rooted in place, watching in despair as the wildfires got closer and closer. I didn't want to quash the dryad's newfound hopes, but I felt compelled to say, "There's more. Your sanctuary might not be safe much longer." I told them what Incitatus had said to Caligula on the phone. And no, I never thought I would be reporting on an eavesdropped conversation between a talking horse and a dead Roman emperor. Olivera trembled, shaking several highly medicinal triangle spikes from her hair.
How could they know about Aethales? They've never bothered us here.
Grover winced.
I don't know, guys, but the horse did seem to imply that Caligula was the one who had destroyed it years ago. He said something like, "I know you think you took care of it, but that place is still dangerous."
Joshua's bark-brown face turned even darker.
Doesn't make sense. Even we don't know what this place was.
A house, Meg said. A big house on stilts. These cisterns? They were support columns, geothermal cooling, water supply.
The dryads bristled all over again. They said nothing, waiting for Meg to continue. She drew in her wet feet, making her look even more like a nervous squirrel ready to spring away.
I remembered how she'd wanted to leave here as soon as we arrived. How she'd warned it wasn't safe.
I recalled one line of the prophecy we hadn't yet discussed. Demeter's daughter finds her ancient roots. Meg, I said, as gently as I could,
how do you know this place?
Her expression turned tense but defiant, as if she wasn't sure whether to burst into tears or fight me.
Because it was my home, she said. My dad built Aethales.
Chapter 11.
No touchy the god.
Unless your visions are good, and you wash your hands.
You don't do that.
You don't just announce that your dad built a mysterious house on a sacred spot for dryads, then get up and leave without an explanation. So, of course, that's what Meg did.
See you in the morning,
she announced to no one in particular. She trudged up the ramp, still barefoot despite traipsing past 20 different species of cactus, and slipped into the dark. Grover looked around at his assembled comrades.
Well, good meeting, everybody.
He promptly fell over, snoring before he hit the ground. Olivera gave me a concerned glance.
Should I go after Meg? She might need more aloe goo.
I'll check on her, I promised. The nature spirits began cleaning up their dinner trash. Dryads are very conscientious about that sort of thing.
while I went in search of Meg McCaffrey. I found her 5 feet off the ground, perched on the rim of the farthest brick cylinder, facing inward and staring into the shadow.